This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. In some religious faiths, words are seen as barriers to the divine. Not so in Kabbalah. This is the mystic tradition in Judaism, and it is one that fascinates poet Peter Cole. As a man who makes his living using words, he's drawn to Kabbalah because of the importance it places on language. He says that in this practice, words can become a vehicle of intense religious experience. It's part of the reason that Cole put together his latest book, The Poetry of Kabbalah, Mystical Verse from the Jewish Tradition. In it, he translates and discusses a collection of poems from the Jewish mystic tradition. Cole is an award-winning poet, a MacArthur genius. He was at Duke April 19th talking about the poetry of Kabbalah, and he joined us in our studios and is here now. Peter Cole, welcome.
Thank you.
We need to talk a little bit about the Kabbalah and tell us again what it is.
Well, very generally, Kabbalah, as I pronounce it, the correct Hebrew pronunciation would be Kabbalah, but in English everyone says Kabbalah, is the tradition of Jewish mysticism. It often involves a return of a mythic dimension to Judaism, as well as an erotic and sometimes magical dimension. And as much as scholars argue or like to argue over what exactly the word mystical means, I think generally most people agree that it deals with what other people call mysticism.
And it's not exactly ancient in a way. I mean, it arises in, what, the 12th and 13th century?
Well, that's a good question. Again, it depends now what do we mean by Kabbalah and what do we mean by ancient. Kabbalah proper begins in the late 12th, early 13th centuries. It emerges in southern France and northern Spain. But the word itself just means tradition. And so the Kabbalists themselves look back through the entirety of Jewish tradition to its most ancient origins and see that there were, in fact, people along the way, certain prophets, certain poets, who understood what they understood. After all, that kind of wisdom is not an invented wisdom. It's a received wisdom. And that's the other thing that Kabbalah means, is reception. So while it begins in the 12th century, late 12th century, my book, for example, includes poets from the 11th century in Spain and from 7th and 6th century Byzantine Palestine as early as 2nd century Palestine of the Common Era. So it goes back at least to that, and some would say even into the Bible, the vision of Ezekiel, for example, is one with the vision of the later Kabbalists.
What was the impetus behind this movement? What was happening that caused some Jews to take a look at this mystical tradition and particularly this kind of poetic tradition?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also, when you say this movement, Kabbalah is actually many, many movements. One way to think of it, because we want to sort of a simple way to talk about it and to think about it. And there's one of the great scholars of the 20th century, a man named Gershom Scholem, who was sort of the inventor of the field of Jewish mysticism as a serious discipline. He talks about Kabbalah generally as a kind of secret, vital, alternative life of Judaism. That as through all of its different phases of development, as Judaism would become, like any religion, institutionalized and somewhat sort of stiff in its in the rituals of its institution, there's always that more vitalistic impulse. And often it would go underground and be available only to a select few in resistance, let's say, to the normative religious practices of the day. And then at certain periods, for different reasons, at different times, it would burst to the surface, often with meeting a lot of resistance from those normative traditions. So in the 12th and the 13th centuries, there are, first of all, political things happening in Spain and southern France. There are both the example and the threat of Christianity, the cult of the Virgin Mary. These are things that begin to, have some say and influence the thought of Jews around them. Later on, there are elements in Islamic mysticism, Sufi mysticism, that enter directly into the bloodstream of Kabbalah and actually into normal, normative Judaism over time.
Is Kabbalah a kind of poetic or mystical interpretation of the Hebrew Bible, or is it an interpretation of a larger interpretation of Jewish faith?
Yeah. That's a nice way to think of it, as a kind of poetic interpretation of the standard set of scriptures and religious texts that the tradition hands down. And in fact, in Spain in the 12th and 13th century, the Zohar, which is considered the Bible of Kabbalah, the Bible of Jewish mysticism, is essentially conceived or put together in a kind of hodgepodge fashion as a commentary on the Bible. So it's as if the revealed text of Scripture wasn't enough. The revealed text, the surface, contains secrets, and one had to press hard through study, through commentary, through the manipulation of that surface to get to the secrets that were in the tradition all along, in the text all along, but had not maybe been released in a certain sense.
And what drew you to this?
Poetry, what draws me to most things. My interest in Kabbalah really goes back to my interest in poetry, my serious interest in poetry, in my early 20s especially. And I was drawn to it as a poet for a number of reasons. I would say, first of all, that return to the mythic dimension that I mentioned earlier, that kind of the power, the mythic power inherent in that way of thinking. It's the eroticism that was also in that mythological dimension. But above all, for the way Kabbalah has a way of, as you mentioned in your introduction, focusing in a very intense fashion on language, not in an effort to get beyond language, to silence oneself completely, but again, as with this interpretation of Scripture, to go through language. It sees language as a kind of chain almost, or channel or conduit to an experience of what I would call the sublime, but what the Kabbalists have called and continue to call divine glory.
And that is a fundamentally different view of language. In so many religious traditions, the idea of language as a human construction is this barrier to direct connection with the other, with the holy. But you're suggesting that the Kabbalists saw language as precisely that link.
Right. Language is probably the one thing that runs through all the different phases of Kabbalistic development is this, is that language-centeredness. It's not to say that there weren't Kabbalists who believed in being silent all day long, but that's spoken language. When it comes to written language, to writing and to reading and the way one reads, it's a whole other story. So, for example, Christianity, Christian mysticism, is often about getting to that place beyond language. Islam, on the other hand, and to some extent texts that involve Sanskrit, where you're dealing with a revealed language. The scripture is revealed in the original language of creation. Hebrew is considered the language of creation. So language holds those secrets of creation. One of the major texts in Kabbalah is called Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Creation or Formation. It's an pre-Kabbalistic text, possibly 5th, 6th century, we're not sure. And that tells a kind of alternative creation story, not the one we find in Genesis, but God in that book creates the universe in large part through the manipulation of letters. So the world becomes this kind of linguistic construction. There are other places in Kabbalah where we hear Hasidic Kabbalah, for example. Hasidism can be seen as a kind of late phase of Kabbalah, certain parts of it. And there are Hasidic Jews, writers who have talked about the way in which the arrangement of particular letters, or a particular arrangement of certain letters, can bring about a revelation or release of the infinite's radiance. So these are things that for a poet, you know, are very tempting and juicy and attractive.
Can you give us a sample now?
Sure. Early on in the tradition, around the 3rd century of the Common Era, there was a group of seekers or mystical adepts, spiritual adepts, who created a body of work known as Merkavah literature. Merkavah means chariot. It goes back to the vision of Ezekiel again, the wheels. Although Ezekiel doesn't actually mention the word chariot. And the notion is, or the general sort of aim here, is that these mystical adepts, through a series of practices and sort of discipline, through a kind of practice of a discipline, would descend into themselves, into their hearts, into their consciousness, onto the chariot, and rise through the 7 levels of heaven, until they would approach the throne of God, where they would have a vision of God's glory and participate in the celestial liturgy with the angels praising God. That's the goal in that sort of mythic sense. The prose of this literature tells about the ascent, and every once in a while in the course of that prose, at particularly intense moments, poems would break out, almost like arias in an opera. And so one of the poems that I particularly like from that Merkava tradition is called, I give it the title, these poems don't have titles in the original, it's called To Rise on High. And it's really about this particular spiritual adept's ambition, what he wants out of this journey, but it's also in a kind of subtle, complicated way about what he wants for people who will follow him on this journey. Adepts, seekers who come after him, and also readers who will envision what he saw. So it's a kind of both a warning and an encouragement, and maybe even a prayer for, let's say, as I think of it, kind of proper interpretation of everything. So it's a kind of writer's hymn for me, as I see it, and also it's, I'm not a religious Jew in a conventional sense. The ambition that it has is one that I would wish for every serious writer and reader I know. So it goes like this. To rise on high. To rise on high and descend below. To ride the chariot's wheels and explore in the world. To wander on earth and contemplate splendor. To bask in the blessing of the crown and sound glory, to utter praises and link letters, to utter names and behold what is above and below, to know the meaning of the living and see the vision of the dead, to ford rivers of fire and know lightning.
Peter Cole reading To Rise on High, one in the collection of his new book, The Poetry of Kabbalah. What was your role as translator, interpreter? How did you approach this project?
Well, I kind of backed into it, first of all, in the sense that I was actually asked by my co-editor, Aminadab Dyckman, 15 years ago to take on this task. But I approached it the way I approach translating any difficult poetry. It's true that dealing with mystical texts involves certain challenges. You have the all kinds of crazy names of angels and numerology and magical manipulation. Some of those things I simply would not translate and wouldn't bring into the book at all. But I approach it, as I say, the way I approach translating any difficult poetry, and that involves a kind of deep sympathy with the surface of texts. And that sort of serious sympathy with the cadences and the contours and the textures and the tensility of a text will bring you to its depths, paradoxically. So while I did a great deal of reading around the material, contextual reading, historical reading, kind of what other people would call scholarly reading, but I just call it reading, I want to know as much as I can about where these poems come from. The really hard work is listening, hearing these poems, hearing the shapes that they make, the figures, the textures they create, and then through a complicated process that's not unlike kind of improvisation in music, creating something in English that serves as a kind of equivalent. And I do believe that translation can do that, even with the most difficult texts. Not every translator can do it for every poem, and I may not be the right person for certain poems, but in theory, I do believe that these things are possible.
It does seem, though, that the hardest part would be to listen with the ears of contemporary listeners or readers or writers. In other words, to put yourself in that culture. I mean, I think of the Hebrew Bible itself being so coded, the fact that numbers and words were, that words often had a numerical value, if I understand it right. And right. So knowing the organization of those words and the numerical significance would intensify and deepen the meaning that for, you know, a reader today would be utterly lost.
That's true, but, you know, it's also true that often during the Middle Ages, not every reader would know. In fact, many readers would not know what the numerological equivalents that have been ciphered into a text were. And so often these things, when they were copied in manuscript, you'll find them with marginal commentary, helping somebody along. Or they need to be studied. These are not books you buy at the bookstore and then go home and read. No, you need to study them with a teacher, because the teacher will unlock that text for you. So in a sense, it's not all that different from students of poetry today, and I mean that in the sort of larger sense of student, readers of poetry, who, if they're drawn to, again, the surface of a translated text, they'll want to know more about it. And so that additional information can go in annotation and notes at the back. While I'm not a scholar, I'm not afraid of annotation. Information that comes with poetry, I think, is a wonderful thing. If poetry can bring you into other worlds, that's, you know, what could be better.
And the Mirkavah practice that you talked about, this is something that, as I understand it, didn't really happen alone. This always happened in groups, am I right?
There is a warning in the Talmud about certain things that one can only do in groups of a certain size. And what they say, you know, the study of these of Merkavah mysticism is associated with certain sexual transgressions and certain kinds of activity. It's not, you know, it's kind of odd bedfellows that the rabbis create. But yes, the idea is that this should be done with companions, a companion, two or three or more, almost always with a teacher, and for good reason, because, you know, one can pretty much convince oneself of just about anything. Mm. You're dealing with the mechanism of consciousness here. There's also another warning in the Talmud that's very interesting. Four rabbis, four sages in the Talmud, enter into the garden of interpretation. It's known as Pardes in Hebrew, but like paradise. The same comes from the same root, right, an acronym. And these are four stages of interpretation. Christianity also has the same four. The literal, and you move your way up. The last one is the mystical. Of those four sages who enter that garden, one goes crazy, one goes insane, one converts, becomes a heretic, one is killed. We don't know whether it's spiritual death or actual death. Only one rabbi emerges unscathed. In other words, even among the sort of set of all-stars, you know, the batting average is just sort of okay.
It's a dangerous right. undertaking.
It's a dangerous undertaking. One can be burned with metaphorical fire, and it's serious.
Is the poetry itself seen as a kind of charismatic expression, a kind of speaking in tongues, this sort of direct inspiration, or is there more reflection that's sort of assumed in the construction of the poem itself?
Yeah. There's a little bit of both. There is an aspect of this literature that involves what we would consider nonsense, kind of nonsense language, a language that we don't know, the names of angels, all kinds of crazy permutations of names, and a kind of skipping in consciousness. One of the 13th century writers actually writes about this kind of surrealistic technique. You do things to subvert the normal flow of consciousness. And there is also a pronounced, direct, experiential dimension of this literature, but it doesn't rule out the kind of reflection that you mentioned. Thought, even reason, are not necessarily at odds with the experience of this sublimity or of what they call the divine. And that's actually a particularly Jewish element here, is that study, analysis, is also, you know, Rimbaud talked about the systematic derangement of the senses that a poet has to undergo. And so these people are in some ways deranging this plain senses of the text, but they are often maintaining a kind of lucidity and clarity in the midst of this vision that is one that's actually very, I think, makes it attractive to modern humanists.
Peter Cole, what a pleasure. So good to talk with
Pleasure's
you.
Pleasure's mine.
Peter Cole is an award-winning poet and MacArthur genius. His latest book is called The Poetry of Kabbalah, Mystical Verse from the Jewish Tradition. We spoke with him when he came to Duke on April 19th. Just ahead, Jim Wallace will take us into Chapel Hill, Civil Rights Past. Stay tuned.